or about rhymes, or snappy slogans that makes them fare so well in the competitions that rage through a human mind? This sort of question exploits a fundamental strategy both of evolutionary theory and of cognitive science, as we have seen many times. Where evolutionary theory considers information transmitted through genetic channels, whatever they are, cognitive science considers information transmitted through the channels of the nervous system, whatever they are, plus the adjacent media, such as the translucent air, which transmits sound and light so well. You can finesse your ignorance of the gory mechanical details of how the information got from A to B, at least temporarily, and just concentrate on the implications of the fact that some information did get there, and some other information didn't. Suppose you were given the task of catching a spy, or a whole spy ring, in the Pentagon. Suppose what was known was that information about, say, nuclear submarines was somehow getting into the hands of the wrong people. One way of catching the spy would be to insert various tidbits of false but credible information at various places within the Pentagon and see which ones surfaced, in which order, in Geneva or Beirut or wherever the marketplace for secrets is. Varying the conditions and circumstances, you might gradually build up an elaborate diagram of the route, the various way stations and transfers and compounding places, even to the point of arresting and duly convicting the spy ring, and yet still be in the dark about the medium of communication used. Was it radio? Micro dots glued to documents? Semaphore flags? Did the agent memorize the blueprint and simply walk naked across the border? Or did he have a verbal description in Morse code hidden on a floppy disk in his computer? In the end, we want to know the answers to all these questions. But in the meantime, there is a lot we can do in the substrate neutral domain of pure information transfer. In cognitive science, for example, the linguist Ray Jackendoff, 1987-1993, shows the surprising power of this method in his ingenious deductions about the number of representational levels and their powers that must go into such tasks as getting information from the light that strikes our eyes all the way to places where we can talk about what we see. He doesn't have to know the details of neurophysiology, though he's interested, unlike many other linguists, in order to reach confident and reliable conclusions about the structure of the processes and the representations they transform. What we learn at this abstract level is scientifically important in its own right. It is indeed the basis of everything important. Nobody has ever put it better than the physicist Richard Feynman. Is no one inspired by our present picture of the universe? This value of science remains unsung by singers. You are reduced to hearing not a song or poem, but an evening lecture about it. This is not yet a scientific age. Perhaps one of the reasons for this silence is that you have to know how to read the music. For instance, the scientific article may say, "The radioactive phosphorus content of the cerebrum of the rat decreases to 1/2 in a period of 2 weeks." Now, what does that mean? It means that the phosphorus that is in the brain of a rat, and also in mine and yours, is not the same phosphorus as it was 2 weeks ago. It means the atoms that are in the brain are being replaced. The ones that were there before have gone away. So what is this mind of ours? What are these atoms with consciousness? Last week's potatoes. They now can remember what was going on in my mind a year ago, a mind which has long ago been replaced. To note that the thing I call my individuality is only a pattern or dance, that is what it means when one discovers how long it takes for the atoms of the brain to be replaced by other atoms. The atoms come into my brain, dance a dance, and then go out. There are always new atoms, but always doing the same dance. remembering what the dance was yesterday. Feynman, 1988, page 244. 4. The philosophical importance of memes. Cultural evolution is not really evolution at all, if we are being fussy and purist about our use of words, but there may be enough in common between them to justify some comparison of principles. Richard Dawkins, 1986A, page 216. There is no more reason to expect a cultural practice transmitted between churchgoers to increase churchgoers' fitness than there is to expect a similarly transmitted flu virus to increase fitness. George Williams, 1992, page 15. When Dawkins introduced memes in 1976, he described his innovation as a literal extension of the classical Darwinian theory. He has since drawn in his horns slightly. In The Blind Watchmaker, 1986A, page 196, he spoke of an analogy, which I find inspiring but which can be taken too far if we are not careful. Why did he retreat like this? Why, indeed, is the meme so little discussed 18 years after the selfish gene appeared? In The Extended Phenotype, 1982, page 112, Dawkins replied forcefully to the storm of criticism from sociobiologists and others, while conceding some interesting disanalogies between genes and memes. Memes are not strung out along linear chromosomes, and it is not clear that they occupy and compete for discrete loci, or that they have identifiable alleles. The copying process is probably much less precise than in the case of genes. Memes may partially blend with each other in a way that genes do not. But then, page 112, he retreated further, apparently in the face of unnamed and unquoted adversaries. My own feeling is that it's the meme's main value may lie not so much in helping us to understand human culture as in sharpening our perception of genetic natural selection. This is the only reason I am presumptuous enough to discuss it, for I do not know enough about the existing literature on human culture to make an authoritative contribution to it. I suggest that the meme's eye view of what happened to the meme is quite obvious. Humanist minds have set up a particularly aggressive set of filters against memes coming from sociobiology. And once Dawkins was identified as a sociobiologist, this almost guaranteed rejection of whatever the interloper had to say about culture. Not for good reasons, but just in a sort of immunological rejection. One can see why. The meme's eye perspective challenges one of the central axioms of the humanities. Dawkins, 1976, page 214, points out that in our explanations we tend to overlook the fundamental fact that a cultural trait may have evolved in the way it has simply because it is advantageous to itself. This is a new way of thinking about ideas. But is it a good way? When we have answered this question, we will know whether or not the meme is one we should exploit and replicate. The first rule of memes, as for genes, is that replication is not necessarily for the good of anything. Replicators flourish that are good at replicating, for whatever reason. A meme that made its bodies run over cliffs would have a fate like that of a gene for making bodies run over cliffs. It would tend to be eliminated from the meme pool. But this does not mean that the ultimate criterion for success in meme selection is gene survival. Obviously, a meme that causes individuals bearing it to kill themselves has a grave disadvantage, but not necessarily a fatal one. A suicidal meme can spread, as when a dramatic and well-publicized martyrdom inspires others to die for a deeply loved cause, and this in turn inspires others to die, and so on. Dawkins, 1982, pages 110 through 111. The publicity Dawkins speaks about is crucial and has a direct parallel in Darwinian medicine. As Williams and Ness, 1991, have pointed out, disease organisms, parasites, bacteria, viruses, depend for their long-term survival on hopping from host to host, and this carries important implications. Depending on how they are spread, through a sneeze or sexual contact, for instance, rather than via a mosquito that bites first an infected person and then an uninfected person, their future may hinge on their keeping their host up and about rather than on his deathbed. More benign variants will be favored by natural selection if the conditions for replication of the organisms can be rigged so that it is in their interests not to harm their hosts. By the same reasoning, we can see that benign or harmless memes will tend to flourish, other things being equal, and those that tend to be fatal to those whose minds carry them can only flourish if they have some way of publicizing themselves before, or while, they go down with the ship. Suppose Jones encounters or dreams up a truly compelling argument in favor of suicide. So compelling, it leads him to kill himself. If he doesn't leave a note explaining why he has done this, the meme in question, at least the Jonesian lineage of it, is not going to spread. The most important point Dawkins makes, then, is that there is no necessary connection between a meme's replicative power, its fitness from its point of view, and its contribution to our fitness, by whatever standard we judge that. This is an unsettling observation, but the situation is not totally desperate. Although some memes definitely manipulate us into collaborating on their replication in spite of our judging them useless or ugly or even dangerous to our health and welfare, many, most if we are lucky, of the memes that replicate themselves do so not just with our blessings but because of our esteem for them. I think there can be little controversy that the following memes are, all things considered, good from our perspective, and not just from their own perspective as selfish self-replicators. Such very general memes as cooperation, music, writing, calendars, education, environmental awareness, arms reduction, and such particular memes as The Prisoner's Dilemma, The Marriage of Figaro, Moby Dick, returnable bottles, the salt agreements. Other memes are more controversial. We can see why they spread and why, all things considered, we should tolerate them, in spite of the problems they cause for us. Colorization of classic films, advertising on television, the ideal of political correctness. Still others are pernicious, but extremely hard to eradicate. Anti-Semitism, hijacking airliners, spray can graffiti, computer viruses. Our normal view of ideas is also a normative view. It embodies a canon or an ideal about which ideas we ought to accept or admire or approve of. In brief, we ought to accept the true and the beautiful. According to the normal view, the following are virtual tautologies, trivial truths not worth the ink to write them down. The idea X was believed by the people because X was deemed true. People approved of X because people found X to be beautiful. These norms are not just dead obvious. They are constitutive. They set the rules whereby we think about ideas. We require explanations only when there are deviations from these norms. Nobody has to explain why a book purports to be full of true sentences, or why an artist might strive to make something beautiful. It just stands to reason. The constitutive status of these norms grounds the air of paradox in such aberrations as the Metropolitan Museum of Banalities or the Encyclopedia of Falsehoods. What requires special explanation in the normal view are the cases in which, despite the truth or beauty of an idea, it is not accepted, or despite its ugliness or falsehood, it is. The meme's eye view purports to be an alternative to this normal perspective. What is tautological for it is, meme X spread among the people because X is a good replicator. There is a nice parallel to be found in physics. Aristotelian physics supposed that an object's continuing to move in a straight line required explanation, in terms of something like forces continuing to act on it. Central to Newton's great perspective shift was the idea that such rectilinear motion did not require explanation, only deviations from it did, accelerations. An even better parallel can be seen in biology. Before Williams and Dawkins pointed to the alternative gene's eye perspective, evolutionary theorists tended to think that it was just obvious that adaptations existed because they were good for the organisms. Now we know better. The gene-centered perspective is valuable precisely because it handles the exceptional cases in which the good of the organism counts for nothing, and shows how the normal circumstance is a derivative and exceptioned regularity, not a truth of pure reason, as it seemed to be from the old perspective. The prospects for meme theory become interesting only when we look at the exceptions, the circumstances under which there is a pulling apart of the two perspectives. Only if meme theory permits us better to understand the deviations from the normal scheme will it have any warrant for being accepted. Note that, in its own terms, whether or not the meme replicates successfully is strictly independent of its epistemological virtue. It might spread in spite of its perniciousness, or go extinct in spite of its virtue. Fortunately for us, there is a non-random correlation between the two perspectives, just as there is between what is good for General Motors and what is good for America. It is no accident that the memes that replicate tend to be good for us, not for our biological fitness. Williams's sardonic commentary on the churchgoers is absolutely right on that score, but forever it is we hold dear. And never forget the crucial point. The facts about whatever we hold dear, our highest values, are themselves very much a product of the memes that have spread most successfully. We may want to claim that we are in charge of what our summum bonum is to be, but this is mystical nonsense unless we admit that we are, and hence what we might persuade ourselves to consider the summum bonum, is itself something we have learned to be, in outgrowing our animal heritage. Biology puts some constraints on what we could value. In the long run, we would not survive unless we had a better-than-chance habit of choosing the memes that help us. But we haven't seen the long run yet. Mother Nature's experiment with culture on this planet is only a few thousand generations old. Nevertheless, we have good reason to believe that our meme immunological systems are not hopeless, even if they are not foolproof. We can rely, as a general crude rule of thumb, on the coincidence of the two perspectives. By and large, the good memes, good by our standards, will tend to be the ones that are also the good replicators. The haven all memes depend on reaching is the human mind. But a human mind is itself an artifact created when memes restructure a human brain in order to make it a better habitat for memes. The avenues for entry and departure are modified to suit local conditions and strengthened by various artificial devices that enhance fidelity and prolixity of replication. Native Chinese minds differ dramatically from native French minds, and literate minds differ from illiterate minds. What memes provide in return to the organisms in which they reside is an incalculable store of advantages, with some Trojan horses thrown in for good measure, no doubt. Normal human brains are not all alike. They vary considerably in size, shape, and the myriad details of connection on which their prowess depends. But the most striking differences in human prowess depend on microstructural differences, still inscrutable to neuroscience, induced by the various memes that have entered them and taken up residence. The memes enhance each other's opportunities. The meme for education, for instance, is a meme that reinforces the very process of meme implantation. But if it is true that human minds are themselves to a very great degree the creation of memes, then we cannot sustain the polarity of vision we considered earlier. It cannot be memes versus us, because earlier infestations of memes have already played a major role in determining who or what we are. The independent mind struggling to protect itself from alien and dangerous memes is a myth. There is a persisting tension between the biological imperative of our genes on the one hand and the cultural imperatives of our memes on the other. But we would be foolish to side with our genes. That would be to commit the most egregious error of pop sociobiology. Besides, as we have already noted, what makes us special is that we, alone among species, can rise above the imperatives of our genes, thanks to the lifting cranes of our memes. What foundation, then, can we stand on as we struggle to keep our feet in the meme storm in which we are engulfed? If replicative might does not make right, what is to be the eternal ideal relative to which we will judge the value of memes? We should note that the memes for normative concepts, for ought and good and truth and beauty, are among the most entrenched denizens of our minds. Among the memes that constitute us, they play a central role. Our existence as us, as what we as thinkers are, not as what we as organisms are, is not independent of these memes. Dawkins ends The Selfish Gene, 1976, page 215, with a passage that many of his critics must not have read or understood. We have the power to defy the selfish genes of our birth, and if necessary, the selfish memes of our indoctrination. We are built as gene machines and cultured as meme machines, but we have the power to turn against our creators. We, alone on Earth, can rebel against the tyranny of the selfish replicators. In distancing himself thus forcefully from the oversimplifications of pop sociobiology, he somewhat overstates his case. This we that transcends not only its genetic creators, but also its mimetic creators is, we have just seen, a myth. Dawkins himself acknowledges that in his later work. In The Extended Phenotype, 1982, Dawkins argues for the biological perspective that recognizes the beaver's dam, the spider's web, the bird's nest as not merely products of the phenotype, the individual organism considered as a functional whole, but parts of the phenotype, on a par with the beaver's teeth, the spider's legs, the bird's wing. From this perspective, the vast protective networks of memes that we spin is as integral to our phenotypes, to explaining our competences, our chances, our vicissitudes, as anything in our more narrowly biological endowment. There is no radical discontinuity. One can be a mammal, a father, a citizen, a scholar, a Democrat, and an associate professor with tenure. Just as man-made barns are an integral part of the barn swallow's ecology, so cathedrals and universities and factories and prisons are an integral part of our ecology, as are the memes without which we could not live in these environments. But if I am nothing over and above some complex system of interactions between my body and the memes that infest it, What happens to personal responsibility? How could I be held accountable for my misdeeds or honored for my triumphs if I am not the captain of my vessel? Where is the autonomy I need to act with free will? Autonomy is just a fancy term for self-control. When the Viking spacecraft got too far from Earth for the engineers in Houston to control it, they sent it a new program, which removed it from their remote control and put it under local self-control. Dennett, 1984, page 55. That made it autonomous. And although the goals it continued to seek were the goals Houston had installed in it at its birth, it, and it alone, was responsible for making the decisions in furtherance of those goals. Now imagine it landed on some distant planet inhabited by tiny green men who promptly invaded it, tampering with its software and bending it, exapting it, to their own purposes, making it into a recreational vehicle, let's say, or a nursery for their young. Its autonomy would be lost as it came under the control of these alien controllers. Switching responsibility from my genes to my memes may seem to be a similarly unpromising step on the road to free will. Have we broken the tyranny of the selfish genes only to be taken over by the selfish memes? Think about symbionts again. Parasites are, by definition, those symbionts that are deleterious to the fitness of the host. Consider the most obvious meme example. The meme for celibacy, and chastity, I might add, to close a notorious loophole. This meme complex inhabits the brains of many a priest and nun. From the point of view of evolutionary biology, this complex is deleterious to fitness by definition. Anything that virtually guarantees that the host's germline is a cul-de-sac with no further issue lowers fitness. But so what, a priest might retort. I don't want to have progeny. Exactly. But you might say his body still does. He has distanced himself from what his own body, in which the machinery designed by Mother Nature keeps right on running, sometimes giving him problems of self-control. How did this self, or ego, with the divergent goal get constituted? We may not know the detailed history of the infestation. The Jesuits famously say, "Give us the first 5 years of a child's life, and you can have the rest." So it may be very early in the priest's life that this particular meme secured a stronghold. Or it may have been later. And it may have happened very gradually. But whenever and however it happened, it has been incorporated by the priest, at least for the time being, into his identity. I am not saying that because the priest's body is doomed to sire no offspring, this is a bad or unnatural thing. That would be to side with our selfish genes, which is exactly what we don't want to do. I am saying that this is just the most extreme and hence vivid example of the process that has made us all. Ourselves have been created out of the interplay of memes exploiting and redirecting the machinery Mother Nature has given us. My brain harbors the memes for celibacy and chastity. I couldn't write about them otherwise. But they never managed to get into the driver's seat in me. I do not identify with them. My brain also harbors the meme for fasting or dieting, and I wish I could get it more often into the driver's seat so that I could more wholeheartedly diet. But for one reason or another, the coalitions of memes that would incorporate the meme for dieting into my whole heart seldom form a government with long-term stability. No one meme rules anybody. What makes a person the person he or she is are the coalitions of memes that govern, that play the long-term roles in determining which decisions are made along the way. We will examine more closely this idea in chapters 16 and 17. Whether or not the meme perspective can be turned into science In its philosophical guise, it has already done much more good than harm, contrary to what Gould has claimed, even though, as we shall discuss, there may be other applications of Darwinian thinking in the social sciences that truly deserve Gould's condemnation. What, in fact, is the alternative to this through-and-through Darwinian vision of a mind? A last hope for the Darwin dreaders is simply to deny that what happens to memes when they enter a mind could ever, ever be explained in reductionistic, mechanistic terms. One way would be to espouse outright Cartesian dualism. The mind just can't be the brain, but rather some other place in which great and mysterious alchemical processes occur, transforming the raw materials they are fed, the cultural items we are calling memes, into new items that transcend their sources in ways that are simply beyond the ken of science. A slightly less radical way of supporting the same defensive view is to concede that the mind is, after all, just the brain, which is a physical entity bound by all the laws of physics and chemistry, but insist that it nevertheless does its chores in ways that defy scientific analysis. This view has often been suggested by the linguist Noam Chomsky and enthusiastically defended by his former colleague, the philosopher-slash-psychologist Jerry Fodor, 1983, and more recently by another philosopher, Colin McGinn, 1991. We can see that this is a saltational view of the mind, positing great leaps in design space that get explained as acts of sheer genius or intrinsic creativity or something else science-defying. It insists that somehow the brain itself is a skyhook and refuses to settle for what the wily Darwinian offers. The brain, thanks to all the cranes that have formed it in the first place and all the cranes that have entered it in the second place, is itself a prodigious, but not mysterious, lifter in design space. It will take some further work to turn this highly metaphorical confrontation into a more literal one, and resolve it in Chapter 13. Fortunately for me, much of this work has already been done by me, so I can once again avoid reinventing the wheel by simply reusing a wheel I've made before. My next exaptation is from my 1992 Darwin lecture at Darwin College, Cambridge. Dennett, 1994b. Chapter 12, The Invasion of Human Brains by Culture, in the form of memes, has created human minds, which alone among animal minds can conceive of things distant and future, and formulate alternative goals. The prospects for elaborating a rigorous science of memetics are doubtful, but the concept provides a valuable perspective from which to investigate the complex relationship between cultural and genetic heritage. In particular, it is the shaping of our minds by memes that gives us the autonomy to transcend our selfish genes. Chapter 13, A series of ever more powerful types of mind can be defined in terms of the tower of generate and test, which takes us from the crudest trial and error learners to the community of scientists and other serious human thinkers. Language plays the crucial role in this cascade of cranes, and Noam Chomsky's pioneering work in linguistics opens up the prospect of a Darwinian theory of language. But this is a prospect he has mistakenly shunned, along with Gould. The controversies surrounding the development in recent years of a science of the mind have been sadly amplified into antagonisms by misperceptions on both sides. Are the critics calling for cranes or skyhooks? Chapter 13, Losing Our Minds to Darwin. 1. The role of language in intelligence. When ideas fail, words come in very handy. Anonymous. We are not like other animals. Our minds set us off from them. That is the claim that inspires such passionate defense. It is curious that people who want so much to defend this difference should be so reluctant to examine the evidence in its favor coming from evolutionary biology, ethology, primatology, and cognitive science. Presumably they are afraid they might learn that, although we are different, we aren't different enough to make the life-defining difference they cherish. For Descartes, after all, the difference was absolute and metaphysical. Animals were just mindless automata. We have souls. Descartes and his followers have suffered calumny over the centuries at the hands of animal lovers, who have deplored his claim that animals have no souls. More theoretically minded critics have deplored his faint-heartedness from the opposite pole. How could such a sound, ingenious mechanist flinch so badly when it came to making an exception for humanity? Of course our minds are our brains, and hence are ultimately just stupendously complex machines. The difference between us and other animals is one of huge degree, not metaphysical kind. It is no coincidence, I have shown, that those who deplore artificial intelligence are also those who deplore evolutionary accounts of human mentality. If human minds are non-miraculous products of evolution, then they are, in the requisite sense, artifacts, and all their powers must have an ultimately mechanical explanation. We are descended from macros and made of macros, and nothing we can do is anything beyond the power of huge assemblies of macros, assembled in space and time. Still, there is a huge difference between our minds and the minds of other species, a gulf wide enough even to make a moral difference. It must be due to two intermeshed factors, each of which requires a Darwinian explanation. 1. The brains we are born with have features lacking in other brains, features that have evolved under selection pressure over the last 6 million years or so. And 2. These features make possible an enormous elaboration of powers that accrue from the sharing of design wealth through cultural transmission. The pivotal phenomenon that unites these two factors is language. We human beings may not be the most admirable species on the planet, or the most likely to survive for another millennium, but we are, without any doubt at all, the most intelligent. We are also the only species with language. Is that true? Don't whales and dolphins, vervet monkeys and honeybees, the list goes on, have languages of sorts? Haven't chimpanzees in laboratories been taught rudimentary languages of sorts? Yes, and body language is a sort of language, and music is the international language, sort of, and politics is a sort of language, and the complex world of odor and olfaction is another, highly emotionally charged language, and so on. It sometimes seems that the highest praise we can bestow on a phenomenon we are studying is the claim that its complexities entitle it to be called a language, of sorts. This admiration for language, real language, the sort only we human beings use, is well-founded. The expressive information encoding properties of real language are practically limitless, in at least some dimensions, and the powers that other species acquire in virtue of their use of proto-languages, hemi-semi-demi-languages, are indeed similar to the powers we acquire thanks to our use of real language. These other species do climb a few steps up the mountain on whose summit we reside, thanks to language. Looking at the vast differences between their gains and ours is one way of approaching the question we now must address. Just how does language contribute to intelligence? What varieties of thought require language? What varieties of thought, if any, are possible without language? We watch a chimpanzee with her soulful face, inquisitive eyes, and deft fingers, and we very definitely get a sense of the mind within. But the more we watch, the more our picture of her mind swims before our eyes. In some ways, she is so human, so insightful. Yet we soon learn, to our dismay or relief, depending on our hopes, that in other ways she is so dense, so uncomprehending, so unreachably cut off from our human world. How could a chimp who so obviously understands A fail to understand B? Consider a few simple questions about chimpanzees. Could they learn to tend a fire? Could they gather firewood, keep it dry, preserve the coals, break the wood, keep the fire size within proper bounds? And if they couldn't invent these novel activities on their own, could they be trained by human beings to do these things? Here's another question. Suppose you imagine something novel. I hereby invite you to imagine a man climbing up a rope with a plastic garbage pail over his head. An easy mental task for you. Could a chimpanzee do the same thing in her mind's eye? I wonder. I chose the elements, man, rope, climbing, pail, head, as familiar objects in the perceptual and behavioral world of a laboratory chimp. But I wonder whether a chimp could put them together in this novel way, even by accident, as it were. You were provoked to perform your mental act by my verbal suggestion, and probably you often perform similar mental acts on your own in response to verbal suggestions you give yourself. Not out loud, but definitely in words. Could it be otherwise? Could a chimpanzee get itself to perform such a mental act without the help of verbal suggestion? These are rather simple questions about chimpanzees, but nobody knows the answers, yet. The answers are not impossible to acquire, but not easy either. Controlled experiments could yield the answers which would shed light on the role of language in turning brains into minds like ours. I raise the question about whether chimpanzees could learn to tend a fire because, at some point in prehistory, our ancestors tamed fire. Was language necessary for this great civilizing advance? Some of the evidence suggests that it happened hundreds of thousands of years, or even as much as a million years, Donald, 1991, page 114, before the advent of language. But, of course, after our hominid line split away from the ancestors of modern apes, such as chimpanzees. Opinions differ sharply. Many researchers are convinced that language began much earlier, in plenty of time to underwrite the taming of fire. Pinker, 1994. We might even try to argue that the taming of fire is itself incontrovertible evidence for the existence of early language. If we can just convince ourselves that this mental feat required rudimentary language, or is fire tending not such a big deal? Perhaps the only reason we don't find chimps in the wild sitting around campfires is that in their rainy habitats, there is never enough tinder around to give fire a chance to be tamed. Sue Savage Rumbaugh's pygmy chimps in Atlanta love to go on picnics in the woods and enjoy staring into the campfire's flames, just as we do. But she tells me she doubts that they could be relied on to tend a fire, even with training. If termites can create elaborate, well-ventilated cities of mud, and weaver birds can weave audaciously engineered hanging nests, and beavers can build dams that take months to complete, couldn't chimpanzees tend a single campfire? This rhetorical question climbs a misleading ladder of abilities. It ignores the independently well-evidenced possibility that there are two profoundly different ways of building dams, the way beavers do and the way we do. The differences are not necessarily in the products, but in the control structures within the brains that create them. A child might study a weaver bird building its nest and then replicate the nest herself, finding the right pieces of grass and weaving them in the right order, creating, by the very same series of steps, an identical nest. A film of the two building processes occurring side by side might overwhelm us with a sense that we were seeing the same phenomenon twice. but it would be a big mistake to impute to the bird the sort of thought processes we know or imagine to be going on in the child. There could be very little in common between the processes going on in the child's brain and in the bird's brain. The bird is apparently endowed with a collection of interlocking, special-purpose, minimalist subroutines, well-designed by evolution, according to the notorious need-to-know principle of espionage. Give each agent as little information as will suffice for it to accomplish its share of the mission. Control systems designed under this principle can be astonishingly successful. Witness the bird's nests, after all. Whenever the environment has enough simplicity and regularity, and hence predictability, to favor pre-design of the whole system. The system's very design, in effect, makes a prediction, a wager, in fact, that the environment will be the way it must be for the system to work. When the complexity of encountered environments rises, however, and unpredictability becomes a more severe problem, a different design principle kicks in, the commando team principle, illustrated by such films as The Guns of Navarone. Give each agent as much knowledge about the total project as possible, so that the team has a chance of ad-libbing appropriately when unanticipated obstacles arise. So there is a watershed in the terrain of evolutionary design space. When a control problem lies athwart it, it could be a matter of chance which direction evolution propels the successful descendants. Perhaps, then, there are two ways of tending fires, roughly the Beaver Dam way and our way. If so, it's a good thing for us that our ancestors didn't hit upon the Beaver Dam way, for if they had, the woods might today be full of apes sitting around campfires, but we would not be here to marvel at them. I want to propose a framework in which we can place the various design options for brains to see where their power comes from. It is an outrageously oversimplified structure, but idealization is the price one should often be willing to pay for synoptic insight. I call it the Tower of Generate and Test. As each new floor of the tower gets constructed, it empowers the organisms at that level to find better and better moves and find them more efficiently. In the beginning, once the pump had been primed, there was Darwinian evolution of species by natural selection. A variety of candidate organisms were blindly generated by more or less arbitrary processes of recombination and mutation of genes. These organisms were field-tested, and only the best designs survived. This is the ground floor of the tower. Let us call its inhabitants Darwinian creatures. This process went through many millions of cycles, producing many wonderful designs, both plant and animal. And eventually, among its novel creations, were some designs with the property of phenotypic plasticity. The individual candidate organisms were not wholly designed at birth, or, in other words, there were elements of their design that could be adjusted by events that occurred during the field tests. This is what makes the Baldwin effect possible, as we noted in Chapter 3. But now we are going to focus on the intra-organismic design that sets up that crane. Some of these candidates, we may suppose, were no better off than their hard-wired cousins, since they had no way of favoring, selecting for an encore, the behavioral options they were equipped to try out. But others, we may suppose, were fortunate enough to have wired in reinforcers that happened to favor smart moves, actions that were better for their agents. These individuals thus confronted the environment by generating a variety of actions, which they tried out one by one until they found one that worked. We may call this subset of Darwinian creatures the creatures with conditionable plasticity. Skinnerian creatures, since, as B.F. Skinner was fond of pointing out, operant conditioning is not just analogous to Darwinian natural selection, it is continuous with it. Where inherited behavior leaves off, the inherited modifiability of the process of conditioning takes over. Skinner, 1953, page 83. Skinnerian conditioning is a fine capacity to have, so long as you are not killed by one of your early errors. A better system involves pre-selection among all the possible behaviors or actions, weeding out the truly stupid options before risking them in the harsh world. We human beings are creatures capable of this third refinement, but we are not alone. We may call the beneficiaries of this third story in the tower Popperian creatures, since, as Sir Karl Popper once elegantly put it, this design enhancement permits our hypotheses to die in our stead. Unlike the merely Skinnerian creatures, many of whom survive only because they make lucky first moves, Popperian creatures survive because they're smart enough to make better than chance first moves. Of course, they're just lucky to be smart, but that's better than just being lucky. But how is this pre-selection in Popperian agents to be done? Where is the feedback to come from? It must come from a sort of inner environment, an inner something or other that is structured in such a way that the surrogate actions it favors are more often than not the very actions the real world would also bless if they were actually performed. In short, the inner environment, whatever it is, must contain lots of information about the outer environment and its regularities. Nothing else, except magic, could provide pre-selection worth having. Now, here we must be very careful not to think of this inner environment as simply a replica of the outer world, with all its physical contingencies reproduced. In such a miraculous toy world, the little hot stove in your head would be hot enough actually to burn the little finger in your head that you placed on it. The information about the world has to be there, but it also has to be structured in such a way that there is a non-miraculous explanation of how it got there, how it is maintained, and how it actually achieves the pre-selective effects that are its raison d'etre. Which animals are Popperian creatures and which are merely Skinnerian? Pigeons were Skinner's favorite experimental animals, and he and his followers developed the technology of operant conditioning to a very sophisticated level, getting pigeons to exhibit quite bizarre and sophisticated learned behaviors. Notoriously, the Skinnerians never succeeded in proving that pigeons were not Popperian creatures, and research on a host of different species, from octopuses to fish to mammals, strongly suggests that if there are any purely Skinnerian creatures, capable only of blind trial and error learning, they are to be found among the simple invertebrates. The sea slug, Aplysia, has more or less replaced the pigeon as the focus of attention among those who study the mechanisms of simple conditioning. Researchers unhesitatingly and uncontroversially rank species in terms of how intelligent they are. This involves no myopic endorsement of the great chain of being, no unwarranted assumptions about climbing the ladder of progress. It depends on objective measures of cognitive competence. The octopus, for instance, is stunningly smart, a fact that would not be available to surprise us if there weren't ways of measuring intelligence that are independent of phylogenetic chauvinism. We do not differ from all other species in being Popperian creatures, then. Far from it. Mammals and birds and reptiles and fish all exhibit the capacity to use information from their environments to pre-sort their behavioral options before striking out. We have now reached the story of the tower on which I want to build. Once we get to Popperian creatures, creatures whose brains have the potential to be shaped into inner environments with pre-selective prowess, what happens next? How does new information about the outer environment get incorporated into these brains? This is where earlier design decisions come back to haunt, to constrain the designer. In particular, choices that evolution has already made between need to know and commando team now put major constraints on the options for design improvement. If a particular species' brain design has already gone down the need-to-know path with regard to some control problem. Only minor modifications, fine-tuning you might say, can be readily made to the existing structures. So the only hope of making a major revision of the internal environment to account for new problems, new features of the external environment that matter, is to submerge the old hard wiring under a new layer of preemptive control, a theme developed in the work of the AI researcher Rodney Brooks, for example, 1991. It is these higher levels of control that have the potential for vast increases in versatility. And it is at these levels in particular that we should look for the role of language, when it finally arrives on the scene, in turning our brains into virtuoso pre-selectors. We engage in our share of rather mindless routine behavior, but our important acts are often directed on the world with incredible cunning, composing projects exquisitely designed under the influence of vast libraries of information about the world. The instinctual actions we share with other species show the benefits derived from the harrowing explorations of our ancestors. The imitative actions we share with some higher animals may show the benefits of information gathered not just by our ancestors, but also by our social groups over generations, transmitted non-genetically by a tradition of imitation. But our more deliberatively planned acts show the benefits of information gathered and transmitted by our conspecifics in every culture, including, moreover, items of information that no single individual has embodied or understood in any sense. And though some of this information may be of rather ancient acquisition, much of it is brand new. When comparing the timescales of genetic and cultural evolution, it is useful to bear in mind that we today, every one of us, can easily understand many ideas that were simply unthinkable by the geniuses in our grandparents' generation. The successors to mere papyrian creatures are those whose inner environments are informed by the designed portions of the outer environment. We may call this subset of Darwinian creatures Gregorian creatures, since the British psychologist Richard Gregory is, to my mind, the preeminent theorist of the role of information, or more exactly what Gregory calls potential intelligence, in the creation of smart moves, or what Gregory calls kinetic intelligence. Gregory observes that a pair of scissors, as a well-designed artifact, is not just a result of intelligence, but an endower of intelligence, external potential intelligence, in a very straightforward and intuitive sense. When you give someone a pair of scissors, you enhance his potential to arrive more safely and swiftly at smart moves. Gregory, 1981, page 311, and the pages directly after. Anthropologists have long recognized that the advent of tool use accompanied a major increase in intelligence. Chimpanzees in the wild fish for termites with crudely prepared fishing sticks. This fact takes on further significance when we learn that not all chimpanzees have hit upon the trick. In some chimpanzee cultures, termites are a present but unexploited food source. That reminds us that tool use is a two-way sign of intelligence. Not only does it require intelligence to recognize and maintain a tool, let alone fabricate one, but tool use confers intelligence on those who are lucky enough to be given the tool. The better designed the tool, the more information embedded in its fabrication, the more potential intelligence it confers on its user. And among the preeminent tools, Gregory reminds us, are what he calls mind tools, words. Words and other mind tools give a Gregorian creature an inner environment that permits it to construct ever more subtle move generators and move testers. Skinnerian creatures ask themselves, "What do I do next?" and haven't a clue how to answer until they have taken some hard knocks. Papyrian creatures make a big advance by asking themselves, what should I think about next, before they ask themselves, what should I do next? Gregorian creatures take a further big step by learning how to think better about what they should think about next, and so forth. A tower of further internal reflections, with no fixed or discernible limit. What happens to a human or hominid brain when it becomes equipped with words? In particular, what is the shape of this environment when words first enter it? It is definitely not an even playing field or a tabula rasa. Our newfound words must anchor themselves on the hills and valleys of a landscape of considerable complexity. Thanks to earlier evolutionary pressures, our innate quality spaces are species-specific, narcissistic, and even idiosyncratic from individual to individual. A number of investigators are currently exploring portions of this terrain. The psychologist Frank Keel, 1992, and his colleagues at Cornell have evidenced that certain highly abstract concepts, such as the concepts of being alive or ownership, for instance, have a genetically imposed head start in the young child's kit of mind tools. When the specific words for owning, giving and taking, keeping and hiding, and their kin enter a child's brain, they find homes already partially built for them. Ray Jackendoff, 1993, and other linguists have identified fundamental structures of spatial representation, notably designed to enhance the control of locomotion and the placement of movable things, that underlie our intuitions about concepts like beside, on, behind, and their kin. Nicholas Humphrey, 1976, 1983, 1986, has argued that there must be a genetic predisposition for adopting the intentional stance. And Alan Leslie, 1992, and others have developed evidence for this in the form of what he calls a theory of mind module, designed to generate second-order beliefs, beliefs about the beliefs and other mental states of others. Some autistic children seem to be well described as suffering from the disabling of this module, for which they can occasionally make interesting compensatory adjustments. For an overview, see Baron Cohen, 1995. So the words, and hence memes, that take up residence in a brain, like so many earlier design novelties we have considered, enhance and shape pre-existing structures, rather than generating entirely new architectures. See Sperber in Press for a Darwinian overview of this acceptation of genetically provided functions by culturally transmitted functions. Though these newly redesigned functions are not made from whole cloth, they do create an explosive new capacity to look ahead. An internal model allows a system to look ahead to the future consequences of current actions, without actually committing itself to those actions. In particular, the system can avoid acts that would set it irretrievably down some road to future disaster, stepping off a cliff. Less dramatically but equally important, the model enables the agent to make current stage-setting moves that set up later moves that are obviously advantageous. The very essence of a competitive advantage, whether it be in chess or economics, is the discovery and execution of stage-setting moves. Holland, 1992, page 25. This, then, is the crane to end all cranes. An explorer that does have foresight, that can see beyond the immediate neighborhood of options. But how good can the stage setting be without the intervention of language to help control the manipulation of the model? How intricate and long-range can the look-ahead be, for instance? This is the relevance of my question about the chimpanzee's capacities to visualize a novel scene. Darwin, 1871, page 57, was convinced that language was the prerequisite for long trains of thought. And this claim has been differently supported by several recent theorists, especially Julian Jaynes, 1976, and Howard Margolis, 1987. Long trains of thought have to be controlled, or they will wander off into delicious, if futile, wool gathering. These authors suggest, plausibly, that the self-exhortations and reminders made possible by language are actually essential to maintaining the sorts of long-term projects only we human beings engage in, unless, like the beaver, we have a built-in specialist for completing a particular long-term project. For further explorations of these topics, see Clark and Karmeloff-Smith, 1994, Dennett, 1994C. This brings me to the final step up the tower of generate and test. There is one more embodiment of that wonderful idea, and it is the one that gives our minds their greatest power. Once we have language, a bountiful kit of mind tools, we can use these tools in the structure of deliberate, foresightful, generate and test known as science. All the other varieties of generate and test are willy-nilly. The soliloquy that accompanies the errors committed by the lowliest Skinnerian creature might be, "Well, I mustn't do that again." And the hardest lesson for any agent to learn, apparently, is how to learn from its own mistakes. In order to learn from them, one has to be able to contemplate them. And this is no small matter. Life rushes on, and unless one has developed positive strategies for recording one's tracks, the task known in AI as credit assignment, also known, of course, as blame assignment, is insoluble. The advent of high-speed still photography was a revolutionary technological advance for science because it permitted human beings, for the first time, to examine complicated temporal phenomena not in real time, but in their own good time. In leisurely, methodical, backtracking analysis of the traces they had created of those complicated events. Here, a technological advance carried in its wake a huge enhancement in cognitive power. The advent of language was an exactly parallel boon for human beings, a technology that created a whole new class of objects to contemplate, verbally embodied surrogates that could be reviewed in any order, at any pace. And this opened up a new dimension of self-improvement. All one had to do was learn to savor one's own mistakes. Science, however, is not just a matter of making mistakes, but of making mistakes in public. Making mistakes for all to see, in the hopes of getting the others to help with the corrections. It has been plausible.